Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. My name is Lauren Litton. I'm the host of Spotlight on Youth. Before we begin, I want to take a moment to say our thoughts are with the families and entire community of Newtown, Connecticut. No words can accurately express the horror and heartbreak we share with you about the lives that have been lost and forever affected. Spotlight on Youth is a radio show dedicated to social and legal trends impacting the rights and well-being of children across the country. It's a project of the Children's Law Center, Inc., a not-for-profit children's rights legal services organization. The show is being streamed live over the Internet and will be available on demand after its conclusion. We encourage you to participate by asking questions live on air by dialing 347-994-1149. That's 347-994-1149. To indicate you have a question, you can press the number 1 on your telephone keypad and you'll be placed in a queue to be on the air. Also, feel free to log into the chat room and pose a question there. When a child is involved in the juvenile justice system, the whole family is impacted, and strong family support is imperative for the child's success. Research confirms that a strength-based, family-focused approach results in better outcomes for both youth and for their families. Previously on the show, we've discussed the importance of family engagement and heard the perspectives of treatment providers and courts about how they've confronted the challenges and worked to develop more opportunities for family involvement. As youth move deeper into the juvenile justice system, family engagement becomes even more critical, yet additional barriers exist. Today, we're going to examine how a family-focused, strength-based approach can be infused into corrections. The Family Justice Program of the Vera Institute of Justice focuses on this very issue. The Family Justice Program develops creative initiatives with a wide range of partners and provides technical assistance to communities across the country. Some of these initiatives include Close to Home, Engaging Families, Families as Partners, Family Youth Initiative, and Reentry is Relational. Our guests are here to share their experiences in enhancing family engagement in the juvenile correctional system with the goal of promoting the long-term health and well-being of our youth. Margaret how do you say your last name?
DeZeriga.
Margaret DeZeriga is the director of the Family Justice Program, or FJP, at Vera. She works with corrections departments, juvenile justice agencies, and faith and community-based organizations to support them in adopting family-focused and strength-based approaches. Before starting FJP, Margaret was the Director of Training and Technical Assistance at Family Justice, where she led the development of the Relational Inquiry Tool, as well as ongoing work with the Michigan Department of Corrections and California's Division of Juvenile Justice. She also worked as a program officer at LISC's Community Safety Initiative, where she provided technical assistance to affordable housing developers and police. Margaret holds a Bachelor's in American Studies from Williams College and a Master's in Public Administration from New York University's Robert F. Wagner Graduate School of Public Service. Rebecca Garza is a family liaison coordinator for the Texas Juvenile Justice Department. She joined the department in 2005 and has an extensive background in working with youth and families. As a former school principal, she collaborated with youth and families in the decision-making process of the school system. She kept an open door to students and their families and continued that philosophy and approach when she obtained her position at the Texas Juvenile Justice Department. Rebecca provides oversight and support to the family liaisons that work in Texas's high-restriction facilities with the goal of involving parents in all aspects of their youth rehabilitation. Her degrees are from Texas Tech University in the field of education. Leanne Roselle is the founder and executive director of Families and Allies of Virginia's Youth, an organization that supports and empowers families of youth in the juvenile justice system and advocates for system reform. She began organizing family members of youth while her own son was incarcerated in one of Virginia's youth prisons. In 2009, the Open Society Institute awarded her a Soros Justice Advocacy Fellowship. Before starting Families and Allies, Leanne was a video producer, director, writer, and editor for more than 20 years. Her video editing credits include documentaries and programs for museums, and early in her career, she was a magazine editor. Leanne earned a bachelor's degree from Harvard and Radcliffe Colleges and is a graduate of the Political Leaders Program at the University of Virginia's Sorenson Institute for Political Leadership. So I'd like to welcome all three of you to the show.
Thank you, Lauren.
Previously, I indicated we have had shows that have touched upon family engagement, but I want to hear the perspectives of all three of you. Why is taking family-focused approach important, and what do we mean by family engagement, especially when we're talking about corrections?
This is Rebecca Garza from Texas, and I'd like to start out by saying that our goal in working with the youth is to return them back to their families, back to their communities as responsible citizens. And that cannot be done without involving the family and getting that family unit strengthened. We can't just isolate the youth and direct, you know, treatment and target the youth as improving their skills, their behavior, without meeting the family's needs and having their input, the family's input, into what their strengths are, how can they support what we're doing, and how can we collaborate in strengthening the treatment of the youth, the programs that he's participating. We want to make sure that the families are very aware of what's going on so that they can continue that support for the youth. And as we involve the families and find out what their needs are, we want to make sure to connect them with resources in their home communities so they too can become a stronger family, a healthier family for the youth to go to. And I'll just see what others can add to that.
This is Margaret. I think that for us, when we're working in partnership with juvenile justice agencies in different states around the country, what we find is that there's often a sort of willingness to reach out to families for all the reasons that Rebecca said, but that often agencies aren't sure what those concrete steps look like. And so that's sort of our role as technical assistance providers, which is just our sort of jargon for consultants. That's our role as consultants in working with these agencies to really talk with them about what policies will help youth and families stay better connected, what are opportunities to involve families in things like treatment team meetings and discharge planning meetings and other really crucial opportunities where decisions are getting made about a youth's care during incarceration and after. I think I've seen a real shift since I've been working in this field where jurisdictions often had seen sort of the worst of families. And that's why for us, taking a strength-based approach is really important, because we're trying to help people overcome some of the bias that they may have towards families of children who are in the juvenile justice system. So when we can encourage staff to ask about, you know, what relationships are really helping you while you're here, or, you know, when your favorite team wins a game, like, who do you call first? And try to get a sense of who is really that youth social support, because it might be the nuclear family, it might be a more extended family or family of choice, and it might include foster parents or other kinds of people. And I think it's incumbent upon us to find ways to help the youth tap into that broadest array of social support and then maintain those relationships during a period of incarceration and then when the youth returns to the community.
So this is Leanne. Both Rebecca and Margaret had some things that they said that I really want to echo from the perspective of someone who is a family member of a young person who was incarcerated and who works with other families. One of the key words that Rebecca said was collaborate. And the family-focused approach is important really when it becomes a collaboration. Families are often basically the experts on their kids. And I think that's one reason that systems are now starting to recognize the benefits of collaborating or engaging, partnering with, there are a number of words folks use, with families, because we've known these youths often, you know, from the time they were born. And we know a lot of times what makes them tick. And so we have something to say, and to add, we have an expertise that's valuable to the process when some other folks are stepping in with their expertise to help make sure that that young person gets turned around and on a positive path. The thing that families have to offer not only is our expertise and our care for those youth, and as Margaret mentioned, we consider that the definition of family is a broad definition, and there are many people who love and care for the young people who get in trouble with the law, and taking a strengths-based approach to us is really key. Very, very often, too often, in fact, according to research that families have done, we have felt blamed, and systems are now starting very, very slowly, but starting, and this is a positive step, to move away from that framework where they see families as the source of the problem toward a framework where they will collaborate with families in a strengths-based way, helping them to find services they need when that's appropriate, but collaborating with them for the benefit of the young people and their care.
And I definitely want us to spend some time talking about what that looks like on the ground and the impact it's made. I just want to see if there was anything anyone wanted to add around the research and the impact it shows of family engagement. And you're all using strength-based as a terminology, if you want to explain what that means in case there's some listeners that are not familiar with that.
Well, I'd be happy to just say a word or two in terms of defining strengths-based. Really what that means is looking at people that you're working with in terms of what they bring to the table, what they have to offer. It's the opposite of what is often seen as a deficit-based model, so that when you look at a person, if you're looking at what are their problems and what are their issues and so forth, you're going to approach them one particular way. But if you look at them in terms of what does this person bring to the table, what do they have to offer, you're going to look at them in a totally different way. And I'll give you a quick story about that. We have an adopted son, and he was not doing too well in school. This was before he was incarcerated. And we were having a terrible time communicating with him and making him, you know, decide that he wasn't going to drop out of school. A social worker advised us to get in touch with his mother, his biological mother, whose parental rights had been terminated, but she still cared about him, and ask her to write him a letter encouraging him to stay in school and to graduate from high school. And sure enough, we asked her, she wrote him the letter, and that made a huge difference in his decision to go ahead and finish high school, which he did while he was incarcerated. He was very determined about it. Now, one of the things that someone who was not strengths-based might not have seen her as a resource to helping him finish school. They might have dismissed her from the picture because, you know, clearly she was in the category of a bad mother. Otherwise, you know, her parental rights wouldn't have been taken away. But this person was open-minded enough to realize that she had the strength of caring about him and his well-being and was able to be a participant in helping him achieve a positive achievement.
Great. Thank you.
And I could jump in a little bit on the research. This is Margaret speaking. I think the, you know, what's interesting in the juvenile justice field and, frankly, the adult criminal justice field is even though everyone in these systems comes from a family and has a network of some sort, there is a surprising lack of research on sort of what difference it makes when families stay connected. So I think we're able to kind of draw from a bunch of different things that indicate that the kind of, you know, outreach to families and thinking about a wide range of family members, like the story that Leanne described, is so important. So, for example, you know, there's been research that's shown that when a family-focused approach is taken with youth in the juvenile justice system, you see not only better outcomes for that for that young person, but you also see better outcomes for their sibling. And I think what's so compelling in that study is that the impact that you can have on one family unit, working with them and seeing them as an interconnected group, is going to transcend that sort of one-on-one relationship a case manager might have with a youth, and also have positive impacts on that youth siblings. I think we're also seeing that there are young people in the juvenile justice system who are themselves parents, and so we can draw on the research from around children of incarcerated parents and where those children are able to maintain more regular contact with their parents, see them, touch them, know that they're safe and those kinds of things. We've seen that those children tend to do better as far as lower incidents in the homeless shelter system, child welfare system, and that we can see their sort of emotional well-being is strengthened when they're able to maintain those kinds of relationships. And one other piece of research I just want to mention is there have been studies that show that even when youth perceive that they have family support, they do better. So, often people ask me, well, how do we know if the kind of support a family member is providing is, quote unquote, the right kind of support or good support? And, my counter to that is always, well, it's really about, first it would be, is it the right support or good support from whose perspective? But second, that even when there's this perception of support, when people know there's somebody out there rooting for them, who they could call and would have their back in some way, we see that those youth do better as well.
And this is Rebecca. Just a word or two on research. We know that research shows that families have the strongest influence on their youth success. And we ran some numbers just on our visitation log, and we did find that those youth that are visited at least once a month were able to better control their behavior, stay out of the security unit. So we see that even visitation alone, just having that face-to-face contact, makes a difference in the youth's behavior. So that's something to, keep in mind, that we should have ways to get those families to come and visit the youth when they are not in their own community, when they're more than 100 miles away from their community, the youth. It's important that they have the face-to-face contact with family members, as shown by the research that we did, just the analyzing of our visitors' information.
You're absolutely right, Rebecca, and I cannot believe I forgot that. That is usually my lead research item, so thank you for adding that as well, because it's not only true, from what you're seeing in Texas, but there's also been, broader studies connecting higher rates of visitation with reduced behavioral incidents while youth are incarcerated. We're looking into whether there's also a connection for how youth do on their educational outcomes when they have more frequent contact.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of some of the efforts have been to increase that contact while youth are in correctional facilities, correct? And we're going to be talking about that, how states are approaching that.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So I know people really do want to hear about some of the projects, but just to share more about yourselves and what brought each of you to this work, Leanne, in your introduction I mentioned, and you also have mentioned already, that you had a loved one who was in the juvenile justice system. So I don't know if you want to say a little bit more about that. And then Rebecca and Margaret, if you have anything you want to share about what brought you to this aspect of the work and why it was so important to you.
Sure, I'll start ever so briefly. We have two sons who've encountered the juvenile justice system, and the younger one ended up being sent to one of Virginia's youth prisons for nonviolent offenses, and that gave us the real up-close and personal look at many of the ways that our juvenile justice system is broken, particularly at the deep end. And after hearing how families in other places, such as Louisiana, California,
had a great impact on changing their juvenile justice systems in their states by organizing together and seeking reform, we decided to start Families and Allies of Virginia's Youth. And so that's how I got into this.
Rebecca and Margaret, is there anything
I'll share what brought me to this kind of work. I grew up with five other siblings, and my parents were migrants, and we traveled all over the United States, and I'd go to schools, three or four schools a year. But my parents always taught us that education was a way out of poverty. And whenever we moved to a new city, a new town, the first two places my dad always went to were to find the church and find the school. So, yes, out of those six siblings, all of us got our bachelor's and our master's degrees. And when I was in the public school setting, education, you know, became very important. And I would reach out to the families to support their youth to stay in school and do well in school. And when I retired from the public school setting, the juvenile justice system had an opening for an educational liaison. And my first position was in helping the youth that were released back to their communities re-enroll back in school. And that was my passion, you know, to have youth continue their education. So that's what brought me to the juvenile justice system. And then there was an opening with the family liaison department. And because of my extensive history in working with families in the school setting, I thought that was a good position for me to look into, and that's what brought me to the position I'm at now.
I guess for me, I don't think there's any one thing really that got me into this work, but, you know, growing up around the dinner table, both my parents worked in a county hospital in Los Angeles, and oftentimes when our dinner conversation wasn't about some sort of odd medical thing they had seen that day, which was pretty interesting over dinner, what we would often talk about was sort of where different policies were hitting families. And both of them are obstetricians. So it was often about what was going on for mom, and then sometimes there was a forced separation from the child because mom had been using drugs, and oftentimes there weren't opportunities for moms to participate in substance abuse treatment prior to delivery. So I think just hearing about some of the different policies and the way they impacted families and sort of didn't always take into account that families are connected to one another, I would say that was sort of formative in my thinking about this work.
Thanks. So let's turn first to what's happening in Texas and Virginia. Why don't you, maybe each of you can sort of say what made the state interested in looking at how to enhance family engagement, and what would you say have been some of the best things that have happened there? And then we'll get into maybe some lessons learned and ongoing challenges in a bit.
This is Rebecca, and I think it's pretty straightforward what happened here in Texas. We had some legislation passed that mandated for our agency to come up with a Bill of Rights, and as a result of the Great Reform in 2007, it was evident that we wanted families to have more of a voice in their youth's treatment. So we got together with some family members of our youth, some of our staff, some of the advocacy groups, and we came together to develop the families, the Parents' Bill of Rights. And along with that Senate bill, it was mandated that the agency hire some family liaisons in each of the high-restriction facilities so that the families could have one contact person to go to on a consistent basis, and not have to find out who their youth case manager is for, you know, the next month or so. And as a result of that legislation, we got more focused on family involvement, and we hired a family liaison at each facility. And from there, I'm sure later on we'll get into some of the things that are actually happening to involve families in our treatment plans, their education programs, and things along those lines. But our state was, you know, pretty much told that we needed to come up with a more focused family involvement plan.
Okay. So this is Leanne in Virginia. It's a little different situation. I represent an advocacy organization, and we've been advocating on behalf of families and youth involved in the system since 2007. And so we've seen some changes beginning to happen in Virginia, but nothing on the wholesale scale of Texas, where they've had legislation and so forth. As we have pushed, we've encountered some openness to changes, which we've been grateful for. So, for example, one of the pieces that we have worked on for a number of years is the whole issue of who can visit a child who's in one of our state's juvenile correctional centers. The typical visitation rule, I found this across the country, limits visitation to quote-unquote immediate family members. And various folks give reasons for doing that, saying that they're concerned about, you know, who comes to visit a youth. But I did note that in Texas, as well as in California, they've opened up visitation policies. But this was one of the issues that we encountered very early on as we were talking with family members. I would go to visitation and to talk with families as they were coming out, and I would see people in the parking lot who could not go to visit. They could not get on the visitors list for that child, but who were important in that child's life. And I would encounter family members who said, well, this person really would like to come, and this is the only father figure my son has, or, you know, this person lives closer, this aunt or this uncle, and would like to come and visit and be a support, but they can't get on the list. So we began a process of pushing the agency to expand the definition of who can be on the visitation list, and to be able to include more of the young person's positive supporters in the community. And in March of 2011, they did issue a new visitation policy that that opens up a process for that to happen. We're not quite sure how well it's being implemented at the moment, but we're very hopeful that that is going to lead to kids getting better visitation and better support. The agency itself also recognized that only 23% of the youth in their facilities were getting visits, and realized that that was a problem. And so they, on their own, have added some visitation times and have started a visitation committee. They invited me to be on that. And so they're working on that issue, too, trying to figure out some ways to assist folks with visitation. So I don't want to leave it on visitation. However, I'd like to note that one of the pieces that is very important, and I know Texas has done a good bit on this, is not just when you talk about family engagement or collaboration, there are several levels that this needs to work on. One is, of course, on the level of the individual youth and his or her family. The second is on the level of engagement with the policies and practices of the different agencies. Families are stakeholders in the agency and therefore need to be at the table when we're talking about those policies and practices. And so we've, in Virginia, pushed for more family voice at that level as well, and have made a few inroads as far as that goes. But that's something that I encourage agencies around the country to do, to figure out how to bring in that family voice. One of the ways that I often speak of this, and I think there's a great parallel with the world of education, is, you know, you can't imagine that you would have a school without a PTA or a school board that didn't have somebody on it who had a kid in the public school system. And yet often we see in our juvenile justice systems, and this is true in Virginia, that the governing body has no one on it who has either been in the system themselves as a youth or had a young person in the system. So that kind of opening up is something that we're still working on.
Terrific. Thank you. And Margaret, maybe that's a segue to you, since you also help work with state systems to help them prepare and examine their policies. So you might have some insights on for others on how to help do what Leanne was just talking about. But I also want to hear from you what's happening in other jurisdictions around the country to collaborate with families while youth are in the correctional facility, and also to help prepare the reentry back to the community.
Sure. So the state that I am most familiar with right now and sort of most current on is Ohio, and we've been working with their Department of Youth Services, which is their statewide juvenile justice agency. We've been working with them for a few years now, I guess since 2010, and you know, it's always interesting kind of what can be a catalyst for change. And I think in Ohio, there was a class action lawsuit brought against the state juvenile justice system for a number of reasons, but some of them were around conditions of confinement and need for staff training and improvements in mental health and things like that. And as a part of that, you know, the state was required to set aside a number of resources to help ameliorate some of these areas. And, you know, from all the people I've worked with there, I would also say there was a very strong willingness and desire to have a better system to make it the kind of system that they would, you know, that they wanted it to be. So we started working with them when they were in this sort of reform-oriented mindset, and they were very interested in figuring out how to better involve families throughout the youth's interactions with their department, ultimately for better outcomes for youth, lower recidivism rates being one of those outcomes. So they've done a number of things. On the facility side, what we're seeing is they've modified, you know, for example, the orientation packet that goes out to families. So it's very welcoming. It talks about how important it is for families to stay connected. For those of you who are listening who may be familiar with correctional systems, they tend to lead with the rules and what you cannot do. And I think it's great that these orientation packets, which are often sort of the first thing that families come into contact with, at least in written form, are now much more welcoming and encouraging of those family members' involvement throughout the youth stay in that facility. Similar to what Leanne described with some of the changes in visitation policy, we're also seeing some of those happening in Ohio. So we helped them create the first statewide visitation policy and sort of set some standards around that. So, for example, siblings who are under 18 were not previously allowed to visit in some of the facilities, and that's now changed. As a result of our research where we saw that youth who were parents were not seeing their children very often, one of the facilities has been piloting a parenting program that helps the young parents develop parenting skills, and there's sort of a classroom-based portion of the class, and then their often infant children are actually brought into the facility, and they have sort of a special time set aside where they can sort of practice those skills with their infants. And the feedback that we're hearing from the staff is that, you know, youth are feeling much more confident in caring for their infants. I mean, I'm not a parent, but from everything I hear, you know, they don't come with an instruction guide. So getting that kind of support early on, I think, is helping the young parents establish, you know, good, strong bonds at the beginning of their relationship. And then, you know, those can continue once the parent is back out in the community. On the parole side, so in Ohio, a juvenile parole officer is assigned to a youth from the beginning of that youth's incarceration, and that juvenile parole officer is now maintaining a relationship with the family that sort of runs parallel to the youth's incarceration. And the goal of the parole officers has been to, or is now, to help the families sort of move forward along that parallel track to their child. So if they have some social service needs or benefits they need to sign up for, the parole officer can help them with that now. If their child's participating in cognitive behavioral therapy while they're incarcerated, the juvenile parole officer is helping the parents understand what is CBT. You know, how can they as parents help reinforce some of the language, the approach that's going on in the CBT session so that the youth experiences kind of more consistency. They're also involving parents more in treatment team meetings, which impacts not only the kind of services and things the youth is participating while incarcerated, but also informs the reentry planning. And then one of the things that I've seen in Ohio and have not yet seen elsewhere, but I'm hoping we'll see more of, is juvenile parole officers, when they make those visits out to the family home, they're taking their laptops with them. Those laptops have webcams, and the juvenile parole officers are able to facilitate a visit between the parents and the child. And from some of the parole officers I've talked to, they've said that, you know, when they show up for that visit, they're greeted with open arms. The families are excited that they're there because it means that they know they'll get to see their child. So I think those are, you know, a number of the things that we're seeing in Ohio.
I can share some of the things that are going on in Texas that almost parallel some of the things she mentioned in Ohio. We, too, have parenting classes for our youth that are in high-restriction facilities, and it's a state curriculum called Parenting and Paternity Awareness. So the youth not only learn about good parenting skills, but they also know how they can assert themselves as in having visitation and rights associated with being a parent, because sometimes when the baby is born, the girl and the youth may be in good terms, but who knows later down the line, you know, what's going to happen. So we want to make sure that they're aware that there are certain rights that they can seek as a parent of the child and learn about paternity rights and things along those lines. So we offer that to all our youth that are parents at every high-restriction facility. And the training also was delivered to the halfway house case manager, so that should be starting up in halfway houses as well. And you talked about laptops, and we also have contracted with service providers out in the communities, and it's a pilot program. We've only delivered it to 5 counties this year in Texas, but we contract with family providers that do take their laptops, or the families come to the office of the provider where our computer's available, and we have family reunification sessions on webcam. And we're hoping that that will also carry out to some of the parole officers that do have their laptops, and that some visitation opportunities will occur. Those are taking place on a limited basis, but we have had some parole officers schedule some visitation on webcam from the family's community to the youth and the high restriction, and those are getting very popular. Scheduling is a little difficult because we have to find the time for the youth to be available, but, you know, that's working. That's something that we still need to continue to work on. And we're opening our facilities to family tours. We have open house where the families go and visit the schoolhouse, the dormitory, the clinic. They visit all aspects of the facility, and I think that reassures the parents knowing that all these services are available to their youth, and just being able to walk through the schoolhouse or the infirmary and things along those lines just reassures the parents that they're youth or an environment that is really focused on taking care of their needs.
I'd like to remind our callers that our listeners that they could call in and ask their questions live on air if they want by dialing 347-994-1149 and pushing the number 1 on their telephone keypad, as well as entering any questions they may have in the chat room. We do have one question, but Leanne, I didn't know if you wanted to add something before I ask a question.
Sure. And actually, it's almost a question to the other folks. I think it's really great, the parenting classes for the young people who are incarcerated. And one issue that I've noticed that's come up is that in Virginia, our facilities typically do not allow someone on the visitation list who might be the parent, the other parent of that child's child. In other words, so for example, a young man is incarcerated. He has a child with a young woman. Typically, because we're talking about youth, they're typically not married at that point because, you know, you can't do that without your parents' permission unless you're 18 or over. So frequently that the young woman who is the mother of the child or vice versa is not allowed to visit with the baby and or with the child. And so I'm wondering if your programs where you're offering the parenting classes also enable and encourage both parents of this young child to interact together with the young child so that they're strengthening their joint parenting skills and also strengthening their relationship, because we know that's the best for that young child of the incarcerated youth is if their parents can have a good relationship, whether or not they end up married, that will be better for them and decrease the possibility that they're going to end up in the same situation some years later.
Yeah, Leanne, that's a great, great question and an excellent point. I think I don't have a copy of the Ohio visitation policy in front of me, but I believe that they've thought through this potential barrier and that they have figured out a way around either a way around it or they've just removed the barrier because let's say it's the infant child, you know, is immediate family and they understand the importance of helping foster those relationships and maintain those connections. So I believe they have figured out a way to address that in Ohio.
I know that we do have that opportunity in Texas. The babies and their mamas are able to visit the youth, and we have even special visitation for the youth around Christmas time so that the babies' mamas and the babies can come onto the facility. We provide special presents from them. Our volunteers provide presents for our youth to give to their child when they come to visitation. And it doesn't have to be a holiday visit. It can be throughout the year that they are able to visit with the baby and their mom on a regular basis.
Great.
Mm-hmm.
That's great.
One question we had is what is the role of a family liaison? You had mentioned point of contact, but is there a role beyond that? And so, Rebecca, you may want to start, but Margaret, you may have seen this role in other states as well. If there's some differences you may want to add.
Certainly. The family liaison hosts events at the facilities in order to have the family unit be built, to build a stronger family unit, and that is done through family days. The facilities have quarterly family days so that the families can come, and usually youth can get like two visitors at a time, but on family days we're able to expand the number and they can have up to five or six family members attend. And they sometimes they have structured activities where they can watch a choir. The visitors watch their youth perform in a choir, or they may have a cookout. They may grill hamburgers, hot dogs. They share a meal. It varies from facility to facility. Some facilities have a marching team, so they may get to view a marching competition. But there's lots of different events taking place at each facility that are called family days. Then we also have family orientation, and this is where the families find out about who they contact, in which situations, what to expect when they're coming in for a visit, what can be mailed to the youth, what personal items can be sent to them. So they also host family seminars for the families, and they do needs assessments to see what areas the families are interested in learning more about. It could be a specific topic. It could be something that could apply to all of them. Family liaisons have also held support groups that meet once a month, and that's a little more difficult to do because not the same families continue to come back, so it's difficult, you know, for visitation. So it's difficult to foster an environment in a support group where the families actually get to know each other and visit with each other and help each other out. But, you know, we make an attempt to have family support groups. So a lot of the events that are taking place at the facilities are implemented by the family liaisons, and that was the first year most of that was taking place, planning events and getting the families to come into the facilities. And then as we moved on and matured in our roles, now we're encouraging families to join or participate in multidisciplinary team meetings, and we're asking them to either participate by phone, or they may even come up and be physically present at their youth's multidisciplinary team meeting, which is where they discuss the youth's behavior, his medical needs, his education, and all realms of his rehabilitation plan. When they can't participate, they certainly get a copy of the plan by mail, but we certainly want them to participate as much as possible. And another area that they're encouraged to participate and the family liaisons facilitate the participation is in ARD meetings in their educational individual plans. So we are now expanding to more of the involvement realm instead of just the information realm. So, the first couple of years we were more into the keeping the families informed, and now we're reaching out and really trying to get them involved in the treatment plans, education plans, and other areas of their day.
So this is Leanne. I want to add something real quickly because I want to be sure to point this out. We Families and Allies is a partner group with a national network called Justice for Families of many groups across the country that are family-driven and working to transform juvenile justice. And we put out a report, that is Justice for Families, put out a report that was a participatory research report. Basically, families collected more than 1,000 surveys of families of youth in the juvenile justice system, and also conducted 24 or 26 focus groups to learn about the experiences of families when their young people are in the juvenile justice system. And from that, we created not only the report, but which you can find on the justiceforfamilies.org website, justice the number 4, families.org. We created a blueprint for youth justice transformation, which includes a family bill of rights that we came up with based on this research and this experience. And so it has a lot of step-by-step suggestions, which is why I'm bringing this in here. Very similar to the kinds of things that Rebecca is talking about with the role of the family liaison. And one of the things that we are very clear on is that it is extremely useful to have a role like the family liaison, in particular, to have that role be filled by someone who's been there. That is, someone who has, and I don't know, Rebecca, I don't know if you all are recruiting folks like that in Texas for this role, but we found in our experience that having a family partner or somebody who's walked through that experience themselves can be extremely helpful for families. So just to note that, and to note there are many other suggestions that we have in that report.
Great. We have only about a little more than 10 minutes. I just wanted to point that out. And you just talked about a tool that communities can use. And, Margaret, I know you're jumping in here. I also wanted you to maybe speak to other tools that are out there that states and jurisdictions may want to be considering for looking at family engagement on the community control side as well as the correction side, because I think VERA has things like supportive inquiry tools, gang assessment forms, right, a juvenile relational inquiry tool. So I just want to make sure that you get time to talk about that.
Great, thank you. I think one thing that that we're really excited about that's coming, I guess it's been rolled out nationally now, is these family engagement standards for juvenile justice agencies. And Leanne and Rebecca were both advisors on this project, so I feel it's only fitting to lead with this. But the idea with these family engagement standards is that a number of years ago, the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, which is our sort of federal juvenile justice agency, if you will, they were very concerned about the conditions of confinement for youth across the country and wanted there to be some national standards to help improve conditions of confinement across the country in juvenile justice. So they helped develop these performance-based standards, which cover a number of areas, including education, safety, mental health, those kinds of areas. And over the course of the last year and a half, we've been working with the Performance-Based Standards Learning Institute to add another standard to their package, and that is around family engagement. So we came up with four main standards for juvenile justice agencies to kind of aspire to, and they cover a lot of the things we've talked about this afternoon. Not only that agencies are identifying families and other people who support youth, but also that they're treating them with respect and valuing them as partners, and that the youth, you know, leave facilities with the skills to draw on those relationships to ultimately improve their outcomes in the community. So we're very excited about that, and I think built into those standards, the states that participate also get assistance sort of in coaching. And so if they find that their facility is doing really well around some aspect of visitation, but really, you know, they're not seeing a lot of families participating in treatment team meetings, for example, then it helps walk them through step by step what are some ways they can improve where they stand on these standards. And our hypothesis, and this is certainly supported by the research, is that if a facility gets stronger in its family in how well it's completing these family engagement standards, we think they will also see some other improvements around measures of safety in the facility. You know, as Rebecca was speaking to that earlier, we may see that there's improvements in education. And so it's really about sort of improving that overall facility culture and the outcomes for youth. So that's one thing that we're really excited about.
I'd like to just point out on the community side mm-hmm. that one thing that I've known that there are some systems that are working with, there's a process called family group conferencing that allows multiple family members, extended family members, the youth themselves, plus probation and you know, relevant people such as that, to come together and to design a plan for the young person's success. This happens sometimes at various points in the process. It's a model that has been used successfully in juvenile justice some. It's also being used in the child welfare system. And people can find information about family group conferencing pretty readily. I believe that that's really one very promising approach to what we would traditionally call probation that holds a different alternative to what's often typical, which is, well, the probation officer calls in the family and lays down this is what needs to happen. It's a much more collaborative approach, and the more collaborative, the better.
So maybe quickly, for those individuals out there who are trying to infuse a family collaborative model into their correction system, what are some tips on, you know, what are some common challenges that are being faced, and how are people overcoming them?
Well, the first challenge that comes to mind is the distance barrier, because some of our, you know, families, as I mentioned earlier, are a couple of hundred miles away, But we have a very strong volunteer department that has resource councils for each of our facility, and those resource councils are able to hold fundraisers, and they're able to raise funds in order to help with transportation of families to come visit their youth for, you know, special events or just on weekends for a visitation. Another, of course, distance barrier solution to the distance barrier is, as I mentioned earlier, we just need to optimize our technology. Our district offices, which are located in many of the communities our families live, do have video conferencing equipment, and each of our high restriction facility as well, we have video conferencing equipment. So a few family visitation sessions have occurred through video conferencing. You know, some have occurred through the laptop webcam sessions. And then the state provides the youth with some money into their account on a monthly basis so they can make phone calls to their families if the family should not be able to afford to make that call to the youth. So there's, you know, lots of things happening to try and reduce that distance barrier and try and keep the youth and their families connected.
I think one big barrier that we've seen, or I guess I should, you know, focusing on the strength-based approach, I should frame it more as a tip, is that I think for many staff in these agencies, they come to this work because they care about kids and they want to see them succeed. I think, you know, overall that's what I found to be true in most states that I've been in. And I think that for those agencies that are not doing a great job of integrating families in the ways that you've heard throughout this conversation, I think it's important to sort of say to staff that, you know, this is going to feel different. It's going to feel like you may feel like you are sort of sharing your power more. There are other players involved in decision making, and that it might take a little more time than if you were to do this on your own. And I think being upfront with staff about those expectations can be very helpful, because often doing a really strong job of the family integration in the way that you've heard is going on in Texas and Ohio, I mean, it's a type of culture shift. Mm-hmm. And like any other culture shift, it's going to take time. It's going to need follow-up and training and cheerleading and all of those kinds of things for to really take hold and to be sustained.
Leanne, anything you want to add?
Speechless at the moment.
Okay. Well, how about we're pretty much at final thoughts at this time, so I don't know if you want to start off maybe some hopes that you have around the future of family partnership and engagement or anything else you'd like to share. 30 seconds for each person, okay, or less.
All right, so I'll start off, and I will say I am hopeful. We have seen interest in various parts of the country in increasing and improving family engagement of youth in the juvenile justice system, and I'm part of a cadre of folks that are willing and able to help provide some insight from the family perspective to that process. So I'm very hopeful that this is improving.
This is Margaret. I think, you know, it's interesting. I think around this time of year when people are thinking more about their own families or feeling far or close to their own families is often a time when they also think about, well, who else is feeling that kind of separation or wanting to be closer? And it's often a time when these kinds of stories are told. So I think it's important to try to, you know, build on this kind of momentum and get people thinking about what family means to them and then to translate that into their work wherever they are in the system. So I share Leanne's hopefulness.
We have written a family engagement curriculum that has been piloted at one of the counties here in Texas, and we are very close to getting the training curriculum delivered to our staff in the high restriction facilities. So I am hopeful that curriculum will be delivered to every facility and that the strategies that are covered in the curriculum will be implemented so that we can strengthen our family engagement opportunities.
Well, I want to thank all three of you for joining us today and discussing this great information. Our next show will focus on the representation of youth. Guests will discuss the problem with waiver of counsel, highlight standards of practice, and also discuss what can be done to improve overall access to counsel and representation. To stay informed about upcoming shows, you can either follow us here at Blog Talk Radio or visit the Children's Law Center's website at www.childrenslawky.org. Have a great holiday season, and we will see you next time on Spotlight on Youth. Thanks, Leanne, Margaret, Rebecca.
You're welcome.
Thank you.